Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of February 22nd, 2018. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Very well. Very well. And we're also happy to be joined by our climate hawk author and all-around climate maven, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
Good. I like being called a climate maven. That's exciting.
Not everyone gets that name. So tell me, DR, what's today's date? What month are we in?
February, actually.
February. What day in February, Mariah?
The 21st.
Okay, so February 21st.
22nd.
22nd. 21st or 22nd. Actually, we'll be honest. We're recording on the 21st. My memory, fond memories, are of looking out at snow-covered fields on February 20th, the last week of February. And that's what I remember. Do you guys ever remember snow in February?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any image of that? No?
Yes, well, skiing, snow.
Snow. Anyway, today, the temperature in the city of Boston reached the value of 72 degrees Fahrenheit, which is pretty darn high for February. I mean, you guys would agree with that it's relatively unusual. I mean, the temperature in Boston today was remarkably warm. It was mild. It was beautiful, right? People walking around, everyone
gorgeous.
Was
gorgeous. Sleeves,
yeah, short sleeve weather. It was great. It was great. But it's February, and this is breaking a record that has stood for 112 years, and it's not. So in 1906 was the last time we were anywhere near this warm. 1906 on February 21st, it was 63 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
So now 112 years later, we have broken that record by 9 degrees warmer. We're at 72 degrees. And it just seems like there's something going on, D.R. Tell me, what do you think is going on that would give us 72-degree weather in February?
Well, it's something that apparently is something that cannot be mentioned in Boston media,
really?
Which is that this is the sort of thing that climate scientists predicted would be, you know, the consequences of carbon pollution, that you would have summer-like weather in the middle of February.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And because, so you're saying that global warming's caused this?
Indeed, but if you will go to your local news sources here, television or print, you won't hear a word about it.
Really?
For
really?
Some strange reason.
Some strange reason. Yeah, D.R., you pointed out an interesting blog post by a guy named Miles Grant, right?
Mm-hmm.
Talking about how here in Boston, basically the term global warming has been banned in Boston for the as it pertains to this remarkably warm weather we've been having for the last few days, right?
Mm-hmm. As I've said before, they seem to be following the Gwen Stefani rule. They simply don't speak about the climate crisis.
Well, I think it is certainly true that there are occasionally quite warm days, even in winter. But this 72-degree day follows yesterday, which was also unseasonably warm, right? And we've had in the last couple of winters quite remarkably warm periods that are out of character. And as you say, DR, they are the pattern of this sort of warm weather temporary. It's going to drop down into the 30s tonight, right? That is completely consistent with the predictions of climate change. And so tell me, Mariah, what do you got?
Well, so, you know, it's so interesting. Of course, there was Senator Inhofe's famous snowball in the
Senate, yeah.
Snowball and said, look, global warming can't exist. It's, we have snow or whatever. And then Trump, I think a couple weeks back, right? Didn't he say something about like, yeah, look at all this ice and snow and cold. We don't have any climate change. And, the note of course here is that, as we've talked about the difference between weather and climate, right? Weather is the thing that happens, up and down every day. And climate is the trajectory that's the line that goes through all of that.
The long-term average, the rolling average of the temperature,
exactly.
Right?
It's a 30-year, I think it's generally a 30-year average. My favorite is, it's like a person walking a dog. I've said this before, but the dog kind of goes everywhere, but the person's always walking in a straight line, and mm-hmm. weather's the dog, and the climate average is the person. And that's from Neil deGrasse Tyson, of course. But you look at the weather, something like today where it was 72. I think I even saw 75 on one of my thermometers. It was crazy. And of course, no one's talking about that, which is clearly climate change. I mean, sorry, not clearly climate. It is a warmer day than usual. And
And completely consistent with predictions of what you might expect, right?
not right. And it goes back to the reason that we know that it's a warmer day than usual is because we're looking back not just over 30 years, we're looking back over 113 years of record keeping and saying, this is unusual. It's not unusual to have snow in February or to be able to make a snowball as Inhofe did and
Right,
throw it,
right.
you know. It's unusual to have 70-degree weather in February. We've never seen that. And you know, that's the kind of stuff that should be talked about, and yet it misses the news.
And I mean, I think that people do console themselves in the idea that somehow it's a fluke. I mean, I've heard, not today, but one guy in these circumstances at a place I work, he said, "Hey, it's a gimme. I'll take this kind of weather any day," on the assumption that it's completely statistically random. And how, you know, we got lucky and we pulled the winning number and we got a beautiful warm day in the middle of, which is not quite accurate because what we're seeing are consistently warmer days, longer periods of these kind of days. And here we have an extreme of 72 degrees in February. And I think, for my money, you need to clearly say that this is a climate related effect and is consistent with the predictions. And if you don't say that, then you're remiss. And I think, DR, your point is that no one in Boston, not on any of the TV channels, not on the Boston Globe, nowhere, they're struggling to find adjectives that describe how rare everything is, but they won't say global warming, right?
And it's within the context of some of the issues that you've recently brought up with the Boston Globe editorial page shilling for natural gas. We've seen the Washington Post recently hire a climate change denier named Megan McArdle. We've seen climate denial op-eds, popping up in a number of major newspapers. And it just raises the question of what is it going to take for science to have its rightful place in the American media. It's like I was mentioning to our mutual friend Betsy Rosenberg, do we need like a march on the media to demand more coverage? You know, the fact that, you know, after years and years and years and storm after storm after storm, you still see this abject cowardice, this intentional, in many respects, deliberate refusal to connect the dots. It has got to stop. It's getting out of control, the cowardice of the mainstream media.
But you go first.
Okay. So, question. I wonder, you know, would a march on the media, you know, a march against the media or whatever, do anything? Because it makes me think, who does the media answer to, right? So they do answer to the public to some degree, but they answer to what the public clicks on online. That's what drives it. And so to some of it goes back to the fact that we don't click on the, you know, the articles that say, oh, it's hot today. This is with, you know, the trend of climate. Well, we do. You and I and, you know, the three of us do, and hopefully our listeners do, you know. But it doesn't drive eyeballs, right? So there's that problem. And then, of course, also, if it doesn't drive eyeballs, it doesn't drive a revenue stream for the media. And so then they turn to people with big pockets that will drive that will, you know, pay their bills.
I mean, I tend to agree. I mean, the question is, it appears to me that it's not going to change until it is in the media's interest, in the corporate media's interest, to bring these topics up, that there are people interested to hear about it. I mean, none of these guys, with the possible exception of the Washington Post and the New York Times, possibly are operating out of a moral imperative, right? Those guys are there to make money, right? And if they can make money giving you true information, they will. But if they can skip stuff and still make money and avoid controversy, it's in their interest to do so. So it seems to me that you say media strike. I mean, I would say media uproar, all right, or somehow make it known that and make the demand clearer that this is malarkey that they're giving us now to not even bring this stuff up.
And I think that, you know, we should, of course, recognize that there are many, many people out there who do have, you know, exceptional journalistic intelligence and, you know, are following stories and are putting out good news.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that
Across
because
the board, but
I listened to, I don't even know which state, either WGBH or WBUR, And so I figure if I don't know which one, but there's a guy in there named Bob C, S-E-E, D-R-D. Mm-hmm. I mean, you remember the name ring a bell with either of you guys? He seems like he always is able to slip in some kind of commentary that's a green perspective. Right. And mm-hmm. I just give the guy credit because he's operating probably in a environment. He's on NPR. So you think that he would get to say things. But he tends to choose stories that are like this coded environmental message. I God bless him. I'm glad to see he's on the radio.
Indeed. But doesn't that show that it's an exception that proves the rule? Because if you think about it, how many people are on NPR, on that station, on point, so to speak, in terms of discussing the climate crisis? Mm-hmm. Going back to the newspapers, how many climate hawks can you name as regular op-ed columnists in the major newspapers? I can think of about three. Eugene Robinson, The Washington Post, mm-hmm. and Tom Friedman and Paul Krugman at the New York Times. Maybe you can throw in Scott Lehigh mm-hmm. at the Boston Globe because of his support for a carbon tax. And the individual you mentioned, Mariah,
who is
the
is it Eric Holthaus? Who's he write for?
He writes for Grist. He's in Boston, but he writes for Grist.
Right.
But think about that. You have three, maybe four, regular, you know, pro climate voices on our major American newspapers, and yet how many newspapers run deniers, either in-house or syndicated deniers? I mean, the imbalance is just getting worse.
Let me go with that, because I think this is a thing that's been on my mind, is that, you know, there's a political season coming up, and we want climate to be discussed, but in order to have it be part of the discussion, we need to connect climate to healthcare, to the economy, to social justice in ways that we don't do now. And I'm thinking particularly there's all these sort of conservative type people, right? There's this mm-hmm. just they tend to dominate, but it's because they all sign up to kind of a theology and they take different chunks and apply the same information to different parts of the world, right? Mm-hmm. And it seems like it's climate hawks. We need to present a view of our politics that I would say has to be centered around climate change and how we address climate change. So if we have healthcare, it's, you know, the National Climate Healthcare Act, right? Just, mm-hmm. you know, all this stuff that is motivated by climate, and we tie everything together. And then you have people talking about climate from the different perspectives that may conceivably produce more people talking about climate, right? Just from different because climate in and of itself is not dry, but it's sort of limiting. Whereas when you say climate is affecting my kids' health, right? Climate is mm-hmm. affecting our justice system. Then there's much more meat to put on the bones. And I think that maybe it's a responsibility of people like us to present a coherent politics of everything, where climate sits at the center of that, right? Or everything is justified by, right? I mean, is that so does that address?
Yeah, I mean,
go ahead, Mariah.
You know, basically, it sounds like you're sort of saying we need to get it out of its silo and weave it into the fabric of our existence, essentially, and constantly be relating it back to everything that matters to us as human beings existing on this planet, which I think is spot on.
And I think that, I mean, just the example, with the penny dropped for me years ago, I mean, Al Gore. God bless his name, or what do they say? You know, God bless it, Al Gore, right? He was saying that for many years, fighting communism was the central organizing principle of the United States government. I mean, we have the National Defense Highway Act. We built the highways in order to stop communism, right? I went to school on a national student defense loan, where I got a loan to go to college so that we could stop communism, right? And so this was why we did everything. And now we need to replace that central organizing principle with climate issues and somehow have climate be the justification for doing things, because that's the core of our future. Anyway, there you go. That's my harangue for today. I mean, you guys can agree or disagree, but I think that it would be interesting to see. Maybe we ought to dedicate a show to talking about an inclusive politics of climate as an organizing principle.
Yeah.
Speaking of organizing principles, let's switch topics. We would, if we were good enough, I'd put in a little bit of transition music there, maybe a little guitar music to move us over to Attorney General Healey. So Attorney General Maura Healey, again, a saint in Massachusetts politics, a rapidly approaching sainthood status. She is doing lots of good things as the Attorney General. This week, she put up some interesting ideas, and DR, I'll ask you about those in a second, but the background is the following, that about 2 or 3 years ago, a company called Volkswagen cheated on its emissions reports. That is to say, it told the U.S. federal government that its cars were more fuel efficient than they actually were. And there's lots of internal, I mean, interesting technical reasons how they got away with it, what they did, what they were thinking. But the long and short of it is VW cheated. They sold people cars that and told them they'd get better, cleaner operation, and they didn't. The United States sued Volkswagen, and the United States got a bundle of money. Actually, it was a bunch of senators, attorneys general, state attorneys general, sued Volkswagen, got a big bucket of money. And so now Massachusetts is going to be getting something like $75 million or more of money from VW as sort of this payoff, as penalty for having cheated on their emissions reports for the individual cars, the MPG for different cars. So having said that, DR, let me ask you, tell me, what did Maura Healey do with the idea that there might be $75 million floating around looking for a home?
She's calling upon the state to invest that $75 million expanding clean electric vehicles and sort of speed up the transition to electric vehicles. Commonwealth Magazine notes that the state's current goal is 300,000 zero-emission vehicles on the road by 2025, and currently there are just 11,000, so she's calling for an expansion of the infrastructure for charging EVs and also pushing for an investment in electric buses so that the entire fleet, according to Commonwealth, would be electric by 2030. So basically this is, you know, she's basically saying, you know, take all the money that from VW's malfeasance and use it to something positive, essentially.
And, you know, something I read in the Herald article along this that sort of echoes what you were saying earlier, Ted, is that Healey said it's common sense, it's the future, it's where the market is moving, and there isn't a moment to lose or a dollar to waste. It's this opportunity to pull together smart investment decisions and invest in a future that will transform Massachusetts. So she's really pivoting that back on economics.
Right,
this is
right,
a smart
right.
economic decision to make.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so there's that. We will keep our eye on where that money goes, because if you have $75 million walking around, what do they say, a fool and his money are soon parted, right? Somebody's going to find a way to use that money. the Greens need to get in there and make sure it's dedicated to, what she said, electric vehicles and renewable energy. So we'll watch that. The other thing, we're rapidly consuming the better part of our show here, but the other thing that I wanted to mention was something called the Pacheco Bill, which is a bill in the Massachusetts Senate. And it right now, I guess, was introduced by Senator Mark Pacheco, but it has a lot of sponsors. I think Jamie Eldridge, I think, is a senator now. He's involved. There's a lot of people on it. It's Senate 2302. And it is basically the combination of a lot of different really good climate ideas that have come up, and they've all been thrown into one bucket, and it has made it out of the first committee, if I understand correctly. DR, did you see anything on that? Tell me, what do you know about the Pacheco Bill, and what should our listeners know?
It's a real combo platter as opposed to the sort of combo platter that the Baker administration is pushing. According to a Springfield Republican newspaper, it would, quote, prevent the construction of any new natural gas pipelines and prohibit a tax on ratepayers to pay for pipelines. It would also increase the use of solar energy by lifting a cap on reimbursements for people to generate solar energy. And it would also place pressure, from my understanding, it would also place pressure on the Baker administration to choose some method to reduce emissions in the transportation sector and the commercial building sector by the early 2020s. So this is a very, very ambitious and bold bill.
Yeah, no, it's got a lot of stuff going in. It even goes so far as to somehow encourage the state to begin some sort of market-based carbon pricing. right? Which, mm-hmm. you know, we'll just call it a carbon tax or a carbon fee, but I mean, that's really important. And so we need to go to a different show to talk about this in more detail. I think it'll probably be percolating around in on Beacon Hill for a while. Very interesting bill, a lot of good stuff in it. As the headlines say and people say, it kind of meets the urgency of the moment, right? This has got the scope and the scope and the range to do a lot of good things. So we want to. So if you're in Massachusetts, call up your state senator and tell her that you like the Pacheco bill. All right. So look, guys, we got to put it down there. Let me tell everybody that we will put up links to most of what we talk about at the blog. And just in case you don't know where that blog is, I will be very clear on how you can get to the blog. It's at www.massclimateaction.org/blog. We have the little SoundCloud widget. You can listen to the show, and we'll put up the live links to most of what we've talked about. Of course, you can find our show on Facebook at /massclimateaction and track your way back to the blog. There's lots of interesting other commentary on the Mass MCAN Facebook page. You can listen to our show directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Overcast, SoundCloud, Podbean, the new Apple Podcast, etc., etc. So we'll close where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the reckless policies of the new administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So thanks for being here, DR.
Thanks.
Mariah, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Always a pleasure.
And thanks to all you guys for listening. It was great having you along. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.